Hello, I'm Kathleen Dunn. You're listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio for this Wednesday, the 22nd of October. In just a moment, we're going to be talking about a major conference recently held on the war on terror after the Bush administration. We'll meet our guests and let you know about this conversation in a moment. First, though, let me tell you that we're doing a live radio broadcast. It's, I want to say, 2 weeks from tomorrow, but it's finally a week from tomorrow, here in Milwaukee at Marquette University at the Alumni Memorial Union. It's a live radio broadcast in which we will be speaking with people from the McCain and Obama campaigns. We'll have some correspondence, political correspondence with us, and students will talk to us about their future, students from Marquette. And we invite all of you who love politics and want to be with us as we approach the final days of this presidential campaign. The admission is free. We're going to have some chocolate cake. I'll have a little bit after the show. Registration, though, we need to know how many people are coming. So please call 414-227-2047, 414-227-2047, if you would like to be a part of the panel. Mike Goucher will be joining me. Craig Gilbert will be joining us, who has been here many times before. He is political correspondent for the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel, and we'll have just a number of people on the panel and welcome your phone calls as well. So, and it'll have a live audience. Should be a heck of a lot of fun. So that's a week from tomorrow, 1 week from tomorrow. And again, the phone number for you to say that you would like to be in the audience is 414-227-2047. We're just trying to locate our guest right now, so stay with us. But there was a very interesting conference sponsored by the New America Foundation and the Center on Law and Security at NYU's School of Law, the war on terror after the Bush administration. The many panelists were really top-notch, and we thought that it would be most interesting to do a program on this. We're going to have two guests with us this hour. It'll be a half hour. And our guest will be Steve Clemens, who is the director of New America Foundation's American Strategy Program and publisher of the Washington Note. He will be with us the first half hour of our program. Second half hour, Steve Cole joins us, president and CEO of the New America Foundation and co-director of this very interesting initiative, Counterterrorism and Counterinsurgency, at the same foundation, and also a staff writer for The New Yorker magazine. The New America Foundation is a nonprofit, nonpartisan public policy institute formed a few years ago that invests in new thinkers and new ideas to address the next generation of challenges facing the United States. We'll be welcoming phone calls for our guests. Our number is 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655, for you to join our conversation. And if you'd like to send an email, you're always welcome to do that. Our email address is talk@wpr.org, talk@wpr.org, for you to join our conversation today. Steve will be joining us momentarily. We're just trying to track him down. Senior fellow and director of the American Strategy Program at the New America Foundation. Believing he'll be with us momentarily, let me introduce him. He directs the American Strategy Program, which aims to promote a new American internationalism that combines tough-minded realism about America's interests in the world with a pragmatic idealism about the kind of world order best suited to America's democratic way of life. He's publisher of the popular political blog, The Washington Note. He has served as executive vice president of the Economic Strategy Institute, senior policy advisor on economic and international affairs to Senator Jeff Bingaman, who was a Democrat from New Mexico and was the first executive director of the Nixon Center. He served as the executive director of the Japan-America Society of Southern California, and he'll be with us momentarily to talk about the threat from Islamic extremism as one of the most important national security challenges facing America. The center writes that terrorist groups like Al-Qaeda and some affiliates overseas are intent on carrying out massive violence against the United States, but the capabilities are limited, and the internal strategic weaknesses of these groups ensure their eventual collapse. What is lacking? A comprehensive, sustainable, and effective strategy for dealing with the present danger from extremist groups. And they have a series of plans of how to do that. First, that there should be no harm done, that the enemy should be there should not be policies based on the notion that there's a monolithic global Islamist militant movement that is united against us, the insurgencies that are particular to each country and are amenable to different policy fixes. We need to lower the temperature in the Muslim world. We need to use the right combination of policy tools. As a general rule, this is an interesting idea, and I'm interested in your response to it. The global war on terror is better conceived of as a global counterinsurgency campaign, which typically involves a 20% military approach and an 80% softer approach that uses other incentives. So we'll be looking at that softer approach. What does our guest mean by a softer approach? Both our guests to this hour will comment on the presidential campaign. Our guest, the second half hour, has written recently about what is the road out of Iraq, an interesting piece in The New Yorker. And also, I think this was yesterday, as he was flying to California, wrote a piece on how socialism became a national subject of this presidential campaign. So we'll be talking about that as well. And welcoming your calls. Again, our number is 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. And Stephen Clemens is joining us now. Stephen Clemens, thank you very much for being with us. Hi.
Hey, good morning.
Yeah, nice to have you here. This looked like a really top-notch conference that your foundation held. Was there a whole new strategy for dealing with terrorism that all of the experts outlined? Were you calling for something radically different than what we're doing now?
Well, I think that the big findings of the conference were that the Bush administration's approach to dealing with terrorism has neither dealt with the al-Qaeda problem or the Taliban problem, or essentially robbed the organizers of this activity of the young men, mostly young men, who were aspiring to sort of an Islamist ideology. And so I think it was a combined discussion of both the military dimensions. Fran Townsend was very interesting in outlining lots of the ongoing pockets of sanctuary that they have, not just in Pakistan, Afghanistan, but elsewhere in the world. And there's a certain military dimension to that. But I think overwhelmingly, they were highly critical of just the failure to reach out to people and their aspirations and trying to change that railroad track, if you will. And I think what was interesting is we had people from the FBI, people from Defense Intelligence, people who were on the National Security Council staff, Peter Bergen, who's been tracking, you know, sort of bin Laden and his crowd for a long time. But what I found interesting is all of these sort of hard muscle types were basically saying we are still nowhere when it comes to, I think dealing with people and their aspirations and moving in a different direction.
Mm-hmm. Stephen, one of the recommendations is, as a general rule, the global war on terror is better conceived of as a global counterinsurgency campaign. What do you mean when you talk about a 20% military approach and an 80% softer approach? What is that softer approach?
Well, I think it's everything you would think it is in a normal, you know, middle class society, in which you've got parents wanting to send their kids off to better lives, be educated, have stable jobs, participating in the role in life of their communities and helping to improve things. I mean, that is essentially what the trappings of middle class life are, and what America used to try to promulgate around the world. I think that when you listen to David Petraeus and you read the counterinsurgency manual, which makes this point of 80% soft power and 20% hard, we've got it inverted. I would even say it's not even 80% hard and 20%. It's more like 99% hard and 1% soft. And that's been one of the real problems, is that in our efforts to try and go after terrorists, we've also killed, you know, significant numbers of innocent people. That creates hate. That creates blowback. I was with Brent Scowcroft and Zbigniew Brzezinski at a major event here in Washington at the Washington National Cathedral last night, and they basically said that when you're out there and trying to sort of change the railroad tracks of these societies, if you've got opium fields that are being grown, we need to go buy those drugs give these people different options, give them different crop options, but what we're now going and doing is burning fields, destroying fields, and creating a lot of hate. And it is that hate which is what is primarily driving the kind of radical terrorism that we're seeing.
What is the figure on the opium production? I remember hearing that some time ago and was flabbergasted by how it's grown since the war started.
I don't know the figures. They're huge. The region, the climate is perfect there for opium production, and it's been one of the ways in which Afghan warlords have been able to essentially fund their operations. And they're essentially equal opportunity. They're not; they haven't necessarily been allied with Islamic militants or any part of Saudi. This is sort of a loosely held group. But what's interesting, which General Scowcroft raised last night, is that Turkey in the 1970s was a major opium producer, and the United States and the military went in, bought their crop yields 3 years in a row, helped generate alternative options for those farmers, and you know, sort of power players in the Turkish side of things, if you will, and were able to get Turkey out of that business. And they were saying, he doesn't understand why we're not doing that today in Afghanistan.
Mm-hmm. Let's talk about training grounds for militants. What's happened since 9/11, if those training grounds have increased in number in the world, and where we're finding them now and what we're doing about those? I guess the basic underlying question here is, has terrorism and training for terrorist acts grown since 9/11, Stephen?
Yeah, what Fran Townsend, who was President Bush's counterterrorism advisor, said at our conference, Al-Qaeda 3.0, she said that the sanctuaries and training grounds for terrorists have gone underground in many places, but have also increased and gone global, that you see them in Yemen, you see them in Somalia, you see them in certain places in Southeast Asia, believe it or not, which I found to be some of the more interesting breaking news of that conference. But you obviously see them in the mountainous regions where you've got a renewed presence, a reorganized presence of Al-Qaeda affiliated to some degree with Taliban officials in the Afghanistan-Pakistan region. So I think that there's a military dimension where we continue to try to work with other nations and governments that control sovereign territory and try and get these training camps shut down and destroyed. But it's not as easy as it once was. You've got a different calculus vis-a-vis the United States and the rest of the world today, and you do have these sanctuaries. And it is in these sanctuaries which the real sophisticated, sort of complex transnational planning of violence is orchestrated. And so you want to shut those down. And I think that numerically, my colleague Peter Bergen would say that we're holding our ground in terms of the kind of massive number of training facilities and camps that existed before 9/11. But at the same time, you see innovation and dispersal of training activity across the world in places that are hard for us to reach.
Mm-hmm. And what do you see as the motivation for people to step foot on those training grounds?
The motivation for them to go?
Right.
I think honestly, if Petraeus and other military and terrorism officials were speaking, the biggest thing that drives people into these camps is having no hope in their lives and a sense of anger over a long period of humiliation. So I think humiliation is the biggest driver of violent activity in the world.
Mm-hmm. You talk about the intensive efforts that are necessary to resolve conflicts. You mentioned Kashmir, Israel, Palestine. Do you want to add to that and talk about the kinds of intensive efforts that are needed?
I'm sorry, I missed the question.
The intensive efforts that are necessary, and I'm wondering what your description would be of what efforts are necessary to resolve conflicts in such places. Well, we can add to this list, but you specifically mentioned Kashmir and Israel and Palestine.
Well, I think among these, one thing is one size fits all. I personally dislike the term global war on terror very much because it aggregates insurgencies, it aggregates lots of movements in the world that are quite distinct and different from Al-Qaeda, which has different objectives and which I think is ultimately undeterrable and uninfluenceable. But I think that there are lots of other players, Hamas and Hezbollah, meaning among the more important, that are casually thrown into this mix that just simply don't belong there. I think the first thing we need to do is look at the world as the way it is, look at how these different groups are assembled, and dial our objectives to a level that's achievable and try and achieve a balance between self-determination in these regions for these states, particularly in the Israeli-Palestinian case, and moving forward. I think we have a permanent Middle East peace business that's in place for a long time, which is almost designed to fail. And I think that we need to put that out of business and begin moving forward, because the window that exists for a two-state deal in between Palestine and Israel is really very rapidly closing. And the aftermath of that is going to leave a single unitary state that is divided by walls, divided by freeway systems that don't service both sides of the state, which is effectively an apartheid state. The reason that is so important is not Israel-Palestine. It's because it reverberates through the Arab and Muslim world as an incredible grievance that they've seen the value of their lives and the value of their society demeaned and not considered on the same basis as allies of the United States. So, to my mind, if you want to solve America's Middle East problem, in which we have such vital stakes, and change that dynamic and begin to turn the Arab world into an ally, we need to not make a false choice between Israel and one side. We need both sides, frankly, and there's a way to do it. And so we need to essentially get out of the process of pretending to be about negotiations and peace, but ultimately not producing results. We need pragmatic, results-driven strategies.
We're going to take phone calls. We have a lot of lines going. One line is open if you'd like to get it. It's yours. 800-486-8655 is our number. Stephen Clemens is with us the first half hour, Senior Fellow and Director of the American Strategy Program at the New America Foundation. I'm Kathleen Dunn. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. And we go to your phone calls now. Let's start with Kasser. Is that how you pronounce your name? From West Bend.
Yes, I was in fact in Pakistan last week, and I was in Peshawar. And you had Peter Bergen, I believe he was a guest a few months back, and mm-hmm. I made a comment then, and I do not know your guest right now. But what bothers me a lot is we have these people who read a couple of books about that area, go to Pakistan, live in a five-star hotel for 2 weeks, come back, write a book, and call themselves experts. And they do not know a lot. And I wish we would read books like Three Cups of Tea, written by Greg Mortensen, who has done wonders in Pakistan. We do not, we need a different type of involvement in that area. We have, if somebody were to read Mr. Mortensen's book, they would realize how complex the situation is in that area. And we see them as a wild, wild west, but yet they do want education. They do want better economic conditions. We end up giving over $150 million to U.S.-Pakistan military per month. If we were to take just $40 million to $50 million and invest economically and education-wise in that area, we will see a lot more progress that would last over generations.
What do you think of that idea, Stephen?
Well, I generally agree with the caller, but with regard to Peter Bergen, he's one of the leading experts in the country on Al-Qaeda and has spent many a day with those folks on the questions of Afghanistan and Pakistan, which Peter has traveled to extensively. Your next guest, Steve Call, is one of the nation's leading experts on Pakistan, the CIA's activities there. My other colleague, Anatole Levin, is one of the most sort of published authors as well on Pakistan. I don't think they're staying in five-star hotels and whatnot, so I don't need to explain for them, but I think that they are the people that we've helped engineer and bring in are great experts. You know, Washington and the public policy community and really the international intellectual community is like a free trade zone for influence and ideas, and to some degree, I think that those who do have on-the-ground expertise, who can go beyond the notion of just knowing it's complex to actually having game plans for what they think are important to try and achieve in these societies, tend to bubble up to the top. So I agree with the caller, but I'm not concerned like the caller is that charlatans are somehow percolating to the top of the field. I just don't see it happening. Mm-hmm.
Thanks very much for the call. I was interested in the conference that you introduced last night on America and the World, picking up the pieces, the title of it. Can we talk just a little bit about the stature of America in the world, which must be of concern to you? We spent some time last week talking about Turkey and what's happened with public opinion polls in that country, which used to be, they used to admire us so much, and now it's, you know, 9% approval rating. How important is this, our stature in the world, what people think of us? Does it make any difference?
I think it's hugely important. I think that the most important job that the President of the United States has when he comes into office is restoring some sense that America can achieve objectives it sets out for itself, because the world looks at us as weak, as unable to try and achieve our ends that we set up, and I think that that is phenomenally important. It reduces our leverage. You know, big powers deploy themselves four different ways in the world. One is militarily, one is economically, the other is morally, and the fourth is what I call sort of ingenuity, or the ingenuity factor. And I think morally, Abu Ghraib and Guantanamo have certainly handicapped America's place in the world. Militarily, we've shown key limits in Iraq and Afghanistan. Small states, as Scowcroft said last night, who would have thought that the United States would be so tied down in such a small nation in the world with so much of its resources. Economically, one doesn't need to really look further than the front page of the Wall Street Journal to see that we have a problem, and that the world perceives us as having exported toxic financial products to much of the world. And then the fourth, which I think the jury's still out on, is this ingenuity question. Can America kind of rearrange its institutional engagement with the world in a way that helps us gives us leverage again? And I think I have some hope for that when a new administration comes in, but I think it's going to be a very tough uphill climb, because there's so much doubt in the world about us. And there's this debate going on about Joe Biden saying that, you know, there'll be a crisis that tests Obama. He's absolutely right. There'll be a crisis that tests McCain, too, because it's not McCain or Obama that matters. It's the fact that the world doubts America's priorities. It doesn't know what we'll gamble on in the future, what we take seriously, what we will just talk about, and what we'll really devote resources and serious attention and ability to. So in that doubt, it is going to be like Kennedy and Khrushchev, but about 50 times worse, no matter who President of the United States is. So we're in a dicey time, and I think we need to get back into a position where the United States matters again, and isn't just looked at as sort of a blundering force that isn't achieving anything.
Mm-hmm. Deanne from La Crosse, hi.
Hi, wonderful program. I wish there were a lot more of this, and the less shoot 'em up and military emphasis. I'd like to briefly suggest three ideas. One is a common interest among good-hearted Americans and good-hearted Arabs in economic and social morality. The gentleman who bombed the nightclub in Bali, Indonesia, didn't like drunken tourists. I don't like drunken tourists either. Another is a book called Why the Rest Hates the West by Mike Pearce, MEICPEARSE. Might be a good guess, Kathleen. And the third is a religious approach. The points in common, at least between Islam and Christianity, there's a verse in the Quran that talks about Jesus being near seated to Allah. And if we'd emphasize the points in common, we wouldn't have to talk so much about the radical Muslim conspiracy around the world. The more we emphasize that, the worse the problem gets, I think.
Thanks, Dan, for the call. Stephen?
I think that the caller makes a lot of sense and very much appreciate his comments. I would suggest one resource which might be good. There is a group called Search for Common Ground that has a new report about dealing with the Muslim world, dealing with Muslims and the Arab world, that I think deals with the moral, the ethical, and the political dimensions of this. It's quite a good piece of work. I was just reading yesterday. I think it's available at the website of Search for Common Ground. So I would do that. Unfortunately, I have to run, regrettably, with the time. I hope that works for the show.
That's fine.
But I want to thank you so much. I love the show, and I listen over the Internet
great.
Frequently. So.
Thanks, Stephen. Thank you.
Thanks
very much. And we're going to continue our conversation with Steve Cole in just a moment. Steve also works with the New America Foundation. He's a staff writer for The New Yorker, and he will be with us just momentarily, and we'll be welcoming phone calls for him as well. Dan, thanks so much for your call. We thank Stephen Clemens for being with us the first part of our program. He is the senior fellow and director of the American Strategy Program at the New America Foundation. Steve Cole is also he's written a lot of stuff for The New Yorker. I love The New Yorker. And he's written some pieces. Actually, I think one just yesterday, how socialism became a national subject of this presidential campaign. What is the road out of Iraq? A major piece in The New Yorker not very long ago. And he is with us. He is with us now. And we'll welcome more phone calls for him. Our number on air is 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. Should you want to join us in on the on the internet, you can do that, and that's talk@wpr.org for you to join our conversation. Hi, Steve. Thanks so much for being with us.
Hey, Kathleen. How are you doing?
And I'm fine. How are you?
Good, thanks.
Good. We spent the first half hour, we didn't even touch on Iraq, and I know you've written a major piece on the way out of Iraq in The New Yorker. We have so much to talk about. Let's start with that small question. What's the way out of Iraq, Steve?
Well, I think the Iraqis are setting that path themselves. The most striking thing about what's new over there, to me, when I traveled there for a while this summer, is the extent to which the Iraqi government and the Iraqi army is possessed by a rising confidence and a sense of nationalism and a sense of prerogative. Now, they may be overestimating their capacity, and they may be in a hurry, but it is their country, and they're taking it back in a meaningful sense. You see this now in the negotiations over the Status of Forces Agreement that you may see peeking in and out of the headlines, where the United States and Iraq have struggled to come to an agreement about the legal permissions required to keep American forces in the country. And I don't know how that's going to turn out, but I do know what it signals, which is that the Iraqis have their own timetable now in mind. And whether that's 2010 or 2011, it is not the indefinite engagement that a lot of American politicians were talking about just a year ago.
Mm-hmm. Hopping to Pakistan, we'll take phone calls on all of these areas, which I know you're an expert on Pakistan. This has been described now as being one of the most dangerous countries on earth. There's not very deep understanding of the new government in Pakistan. And I know that you've written extensively about this. Is this the new hotspot? Do we understand what's happening to Pakistan? And do we understand what we can do to make the country a little more peaceful?
I'm not sure that we do completely understand, as a government, as a country, what's happening in Pakistan. I'm not sure the Pakistanis themselves have a grip on this crisis. It's of a different character than the many crises that they've suffered in the past. Pakistan is the most dangerous, described as the most dangerous country in the world because it's unstable and it has nuclear weapons, and that makes it distinctive. North Korea has nuclear weapons, but it's as stable as a police state can be. In Pakistan, there's a great deal of turmoil, and right now there's an insurgency being waged against the government by the Taliban, who, if they were to succeed in seizing power, even at a regional level, would really pose a threat to Pakistan, first of all, and to its neighbors in the United States as well. So the reason I think that we don't completely understand it is that I've been traveling back and forth to Pakistan for 20 years now, and I love the place. I'm very comfortable there. It's familiar to me. But recently I've begun to reflect on the ways in which I think the Pakistan I knew is, if it's not slipping away, it's certainly shaking right now. This insurgency is challenging the very idea of Pakistan, which is a country founded on the idea of Islam, and the Taliban are making a claim to legitimacy that is succeeding in surprising ways. So I think it's a dangerous time.
Mm-hmm. Why do you love the place so much?
Well, I it's just full of life and interest and the people, and for a journalist, South Asia generally, India and Pakistan both are just marvelous places to work because they're so hospitable and. Mm. It's so full of interest, and everything is open. it's not like working in a police state where you just struggle to even understand the outline of what's happening. In India and Pakistan, you can walk right into the center of events, and people are welcoming, and they don't always tell you the truth, but they'll talk to you, which, from a journalist point of view, is all you can ask.
Yeah, exactly. That's what you talk to you honestly, right?
Right.
Yeah, exactly. Our phone number is 800-486-8655 for you to join the conversation. And Steve Cole is our guest this half hour of the program. Can you give me an assessment before we go to phone calls, which we'll do shortly, Steve, of whether or not there is this huge, monolithic global Islamist movement that is united against us that we think of as Al-Qaeda, or if there are indeed all kinds of different terrorist groups in the world? Can you give us an assessment, overall assessment, of the threat of terror and the form that it's taking and our understanding of that threat?
Yes. Let's start with a definition of Al-Qaeda. I think Al-Qaeda today is several things at once. It's an organization with a continuous 20-year history that was founded in 1988 in Peshawar and has had the same two leaders for 20 consecutive years and operates with committees. So there is an Al-Qaeda, the organization, but it's not very large. It can carry out potent attacks from time to time. It carried out 9/11, but it is an organization with a limited scope. On the other hand, Al-Qaeda has always seen itself as the vanguard of a broader movement, as you suggest, and that was bin Laden's aspiration, which was to stimulate a worldwide movement of revolt by Muslims against their perceived occupiers. And in that respect, I think Al-Qaeda has not succeeded. It has inspired some followers to act, even though they aren't directed by leaders, but they haven't really stimulated a global movement, and they don't have winning politics. I mean, remember, a few years after Vladimir Lenin was arrested for the first time, he participated in a real revolution, and 10 years after that, he was running one of the largest countries on earth. When Castro was arrested for the first time for revolutionary activity in Cuba, it portended the fact that he would be running the government in about 10 years. Mm-hmm. In Al-Qaeda's case, they announced a revolutionary movement, but they haven't actually been able to deliver a revolution because their politics is seen in the Muslim world as essentially dead-end politics.
Mm-hmm.
Hamas and Hezbollah are much more successful at building a terrorist group on top of a grassroots political movement that is respected by some of its followers. And so they've been able to morph into a political force in Gaza and in Lebanon. But Al-Qaeda is essentially a millenarian group that is fighting for the end of days, as it were, rather than for political purposes.
Let's take some phone calls for you. We start with Scott from Beach Park, Illinois. Hi, Scott.
Hi.
Hi.
My question is, why is it that one guy in the whole world thinks he could take over the world if he knows that there's other countries that have advanced technology that's better than his?
What guy are you talking about?
Big Laden.
Sorry?
Big Laden.
Bin Laden.
Oh, Bin Laden.
Yeah. Well, I think he believes that that God's power was the answer to that question, and that he is following a script that was written by a higher authority, and that has a destiny that is out of his hands, but that he's a servant of that script, and that he is going to call all of righteous Muslim believers to this war that was preordained, and that he's just an instrument of God's purpose, and so forth. And in that sense, once you see yourself leading a war that is sort of preordained by a higher authority, then almost anything by way of obstacle or event along the way, you can just rationalize as part of the plan. And that's, I think, essentially the war that Osama sees himself leading, and that's the way he explains his sort of underdog's status to himself.
Mm-hmm. Isn't it amazing this guy is still around, Steve?
It is sort of astonishing.
Yeah.
But, 20 years and now 7 as the most wanted man in the world with a pretty good-sized reward hanging over his head. In the past, there have been wanted men hiding out in Pakistan that the United States has offered rewards for. And though the reward effect doesn't usually happen very quickly, in past cases, eventually someone has walked into an embassy or a consulate and said, I know where he is and I want the $5 million and the
right
to move to Arizona with my family.
But yeah, right.
Yeah, it hasn't happened.
No. Thanks, Scott, for your call. Pam is next from Milwaukee. Hi, Pam.
Hi there. I was wondering if he's aware of the book that Vincent Bugliosi recently wrote and was on a New York Times bestseller entitled The Prosecution of George W. Bush for Murder, for the murder of the American troops who died in a line in the war in Iraq. He distributed it to the U.S. attorneys, the state attorney generals, and the DAs. And I was at the Milwaukee courthouse, and I heard the DAs talking about it. Have you heard about the book?
I'm aware of it, yes. And I think it's, you know, it's part of a movement on the left, in particular among a number of groups, to start thinking about accountability after the Bush presidency. We have always argued to other countries that have had episodes of human rights abuse that one way to sort of put that episode in the past is to work through some kind of accountability exercise, whether it's prosecution or truth commissions or that sort of thing. And I think there's quite a serious conversation in the United States anticipating, at this point a little prematurely, but anticipating a Democratic presidency and a Democratic majority in Congress as to what should that exercise be. There are political aspects of that. How much do you want to dwell in the past? But there are legal and accountability aspects of that. And I know there are groups such as the Center for Constitutional Rights and other left legal groups that are pushing this question. I'm not sure that I hear a consensus yet about what the answer should be.
Thanks, Pam, for the call. Judy is next. Hi, Judy. You're on the air. Judy, are you there? Judy, got to turn that radio down. Let's go to Mark is next from Middleton. Hi, Mark.
Hi.
Hi.
I'm wondering what Stephen's thought is of the new changeover in the Pakistani ISI and sort of their influence on things, and kind of is this going to lead to any real changes, or are we looking at the same old sort of tacit approval of militants and Taliban like we have in the past? It seems, I guess I have some experience 10 years ago in Pakistan and love the country very much as well, and it just seems like the intelligence and the military have always had this sort of backroom dealings with the militants, and it doesn't seem like there's been much change.
Yeah, it's a great question. I wrote about it on my blog at the New Yorker, newyorker.com think tank is the name of the blog. And I when General Pasha was announced as the new ISI chief, I did some reporting about how he was viewed. And the consensus is that, you know, he is one of these sort of professional neo-colonial military officers who's more comfortable with Western partners than some of his colleagues, but there's no great expectation that he is going to change ISI or be able to reach down and clean the place out at the level where the collaboration with militants that you, I think, correctly describe occurs. And there's a broader question that I think is also under-nourished in U.S. policy and thinking about our relationship with Pakistan, which is the whole basic question of civilian control over the military and the intelligence services. We do now have a democratically elected government in Pakistan, and that government has tried to assert control over the army. It's not realistic to think that they're going to instantly take control of military affairs, but the United States has an interest in seeing over time civilian governments move into a more equal partnership with the army and the intelligence services. And yet we tend to sit on our hands and say, well, we have a working relationship with this intelligence service, even if it's aiding our enemies. We don't think it's realistic to assert civilian control, so we're not going to get involved. But I think that that's ultimately a mistake.
We're going to take more phone calls in just a moment. Our number is 800-486-8655, and our email address is talk@wpr.org. Steve Cole is our guest, president and CEO of the New America Foundation. He's also a staff writer and a great one at the New Yorker magazine. He also was, for 20 years, a foreign correspondent and senior editor at the Washington Post, serving as the paper's managing editor for a number of years, and the author of a number of books, including Ghost Wars, The Secret History of the CIA, Afghanistan, and Bin Laden, From the Soviet Invasion to September 10, 2001, The Bin Ladens, An Arabian Family in the American Century, and many other books. So, more phone calls momentarily. I'm Kathleen Dunn. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Steve Cole, our guest this half hour, 800-486-8655 is our number. And let's go to Frank from Madison. Hi, Frank.
Hey.
Hi, Frank.
Fine guest.
He's
fine,
not bad, guest. Huh? Right.
and for your second guest, I'd like to ask, is there, in fact, a serious war on terror instead of merely a rhetorical pretext for some 21st century version of the Great Game? Because the GAO did an analysis of the events following 9/11 and the attack on Afghanistan and the attempt to find bin Laden, and they concluded that there was no coordinated attempt to deal with al-Qaeda or actually capture bin Laden. So are we involved in something different than a war on terror? Thank you.
Thanks very much, Frank.
Well, the hunt for bin Laden has been just a mess, really, from the beginning. You know, prior to 9/11, the CIA was looking for him under authorities granted by President Clinton, and there was it was an under-resourced effort, and it was a bit of a needle in a haystack strategy. But at least the CIA knew that they were the people in charge of it, and while they complained about the limits on their authority and their resources, there wasn't a fundamental confusion about who was doing what. After 9/11, the Pentagon in particular, given the devastation of the attacks and the sort of call to arms that followed, the Pentagon said, well, we've got to get involved in this. And there ensued a period of confusion between the CIA and the Pentagon over who was doing what. They tried to form joint teams. They had limited success, but there was really no clear line of authority or command or strategy or plan. And also, frankly, the United States government just didn't know very much about Afghanistan or Pakistan. They didn't really know this terrain. They didn't have a lot of allies. They neglected the place for 10 years, and they were scrambling around looking in old Rolodexes from the 1980s to find Afghans and Pakistanis who might be willing to help them. Then by the time they sort of got settled down and the Taliban fell, well, the Bush administration turned to Iraq and made the invasion of Iraq its overwhelming priority. And as big a government as we have and as big a military and intelligence services as we now have after 9/11, there was a limited amount of talent and resources, especially people who knew that terrain where bin Laden was hiding, and they were all drawn off to Iraq. And since then, Iraq has really taken the overwhelming weight of time and attention and talent and resources available, and I think that is substantially why bin Laden is still sitting up there making his videos and audio.
Mm-hmm. Let me ask you if you share the view of Peter Galbraith, who was with us last week, who said, and I've heard this before, Steve, that this particular administration just doesn't know what the heck it's doing when it comes to understanding what's going on in Iraq, particularly. You just made reference to Afghanistan, to Pakistan perhaps as well, that nobody foresaw the consequences, even though there were many, many people out there who were scholars and who said, watch out for this. These are the consequences of this. Has this administration been stupid and reckless?
Yes, it has, actually, about foreign policy. I think broadly it has. And I think that the stupidity was unnecessary. As you say, this is not territory that the United States has long engagements in. As an accidental specialist in Pakistan and Afghanistan, and really, I mean, I'm not, you know, the scholar you would want at the table if you were going really deep on Afghan tribal anthropology, for example. But I've worked out there a fair amount, and you know, I'm aware of how thin the expertise is in our government. At the cabinet level on 9/11, there were essentially only one person, Colin Powell, who had any personal experience of Pakistan. And that was an experience of the Pakistan Army, not of the country. There was nobody who had physically been to Afghanistan. There was nobody who had really participated in the struggles of the Soviet era. And, you know, that expertise would be very different if you were talking about Russia or China or Israel. There you would have had a lot of people, maybe they would have been wrong, but at least they would have been oriented, and they would have known sort of roughly what the subject was, and they would have debated it. But as to South Asia, where the attacks actually came from, and then where we invested so much blood and treasure, we just really didn't know the land and the landscape very well at all, and it showed. And I think something similar was true of Iraq. Iraq was a closed country. But the administration wasn't interested in penetrating its mysteries. It had a theory of the invasion that was an ideological theory and wasn't really going to be modified by facts. And so there was no effort to acquire those facts.
Let's go now to Judy. Hi, Judy.
Hi.
Hi.
I have a statement to make. I think the last speaker kind of dwelled into that the war on terror, its purpose should be suspect. Because the project for the new century, you know, 40 neocon think tanks were really shaping the way this government should go, wrote a letter to Clinton in which we needed empire building in the Middle East, we needed American interest watched there, we needed a big shove for us with our military might to start expanding into the outreaches of all weaker nations of the world. And I would like to comment that the war on terror has been a disaster for weaker countries because we fed money into dictatorships that use this money to curb and arrest and imprison dissenters, you know, dissenters that are speaking up for what they consider their rights. And Klugman said in an article I heard him speak with another man on the radio was saying that we may end up with as rich a military as Argentina and just as bankrupt a country as Argentina has. So I think the war on terror could have been done piecemeal, like Gilbrice said. Take each country and talk to them about they do not want these elements in their country. We could have done it that way. But that wouldn't have been the big war, the unending war, the big profit and profiteering war that the Bush administration and the Republicans want to see go on for a future.
Steve.
Well, I mean, that's, you know, that's quite a lot there. I don't really have any argument with it. But
okay. Thanks very much for the call. Let's switch direction for just a moment here. I was interested, I think it was your blog from yesterday even, or the day before. I think you were doing it on an airplane. You asked this question. Let's go to the presidential race for a moment. How in the world did socialism become a national subject of this presidential campaign, which it seems to have fairly heavily the last week and a half? How did that happen?
Well, it started with this really dubious Joe the Plumber episode where it was Joe the Plumber and not Obama who introduced the word socialism. I think he had a lot of encouragement from the Fox News folks and some of the think tanks on the right that he met with before he enjoyed his 15 minutes of
right.
fame. What was really frustrating about this episode for me and the reason I wrote about it is that, of course, the colloquy between Obama and Joe the Plumber that started all of this on the campaign trail, if you go back and look on YouTube, just look at the video, what are they talking about? They're talking about progressive taxation. Now, to equate progressive taxation with socialism, which is what the McCain campaign did, is just a transparent manipulation. Why do they pull the word socialism into a debate about what the top tax rate for rich people should be? It's because they know from their polling that the word socialism mm-hmm. is a killer in America. The reason that the Democratic Party has struggled, for instance, to get single-payer universal health care enacted in this country is because the Republicans know that they can call it socialized medicine, and they have campaigned again and again with that terminology and succeeded in defeating what, after all, you know, Medicare, for instance, a single-payer program is very popular. But the point is that we have a consensus in this country. We've had a consensus in this country for years that progressive taxation is the right system, that the rich should pay proportionately more than the working and middle classes. And McCain agrees with that. George Bush agrees with that. Richard Nixon agreed with that. It's not socialism. It's social policy. And so what bothered me about and what I wrote about was that the media then picks up this terminology on socialism and just plays it as if that right. was really what Obama was talking about.
Mm-hmm.
And it's entirely language that's been introduced deliberately on a poll-tested basis by the McCain campaign, and I find that frustrating.
Mm-hmm. Well, there's a lot about the campaign that's a little frustrating, wouldn't you say?
Yes.
Yeah. So where do you think it's going? Do you think that in the Senate there could be 60? Is this going to be a Democratic wipeout, or is it not? What do you think?
Well, I want to be cautious about all of this. I think if you look at the numbers in of Democratic registration in the battleground states, it really is striking. The since 2004 in battleground states, about 1.4 million 400,000 new Democrats have registered, while Republican-identified registration has fallen by 61,000. So that is a structural fact that I think would be very hard for the Republican Party to overcome in this cycle. Now, the math that gets you to 60 in the Senate, I'm not so sure about that. I don't think it really matters, because even if you get to 60, you're still going to need 62 to basically hold everybody together. There's not going to be a lot of straight party line votes with that 60, because you're going to have people like Mary Landrieu from Louisiana and others who are going to be vulnerable to issues about spending and taxes, for example. But I think it's good for the prospects for health care, and I hope that President Obama, if he becomes president, does what he said he did would in the last debate, which is to identify that as an early opportunity to take advantage of this large mandate and majority, if indeed he has one, and to see that as a crucial legacy project and also a form of economic stimulus, because if we can get that problem solved, it is relevant to the economic recovery that we're going to require.
Thanks, Steve, so much. Enjoy your writing immensely.
Thank you, Kat.
Thank you. Steve Cole, our guest this half hour of the program. He is president and CEO of the New America Foundation and a staff writer at The New Yorker magazine, was foreign correspondent and senior editor at The Washington Post for a number of years, and author of all kinds of books, including most recently The Bin Ladens, An Arabian Family in the American Century. Thanks to Kate Brown for helping out with this, Rhonda Fanning, who produced the program, and Rhonda Fanning, who did our on-air production as well. And thank you, everybody, for your calls. Stephen Clemens, we thank for being with us the first half hour. Just a reminder, I had to get my sheet here, that we're doing this special pre-election forum at Marquette University. You can come and be in our audience. We'll have cake afterward, which has become a hallmark of this show, cake. Admission is free. Registration is required. Call 414-227-2047 and say you'll be there. Thanks for listening.